Everyone, this is your co-host Therese. Before we begin, I'd like to provide a brief trigger warning. This episode will cover topics including sexual violence, racism, xenophobia, and death. Listener discretion is advised.
And this is Liv. Welcome back to No History, No Self, a three-part podcast series dedicated to understanding the historic and current sexualization of Asian women, both in light of violent hate crimes that have escalated against this demographic throughout this year, and also in honor of AAPI History Month. The name of our podcast comes from a loose interpretation of a quote by Jose Rizal, a Philippine revolutionary who argues that we don't understand ourselves without first understanding history, and we feel this is especially true when it comes to understanding the root of the violence that Asian women face today.
Through our podcast, we hope to not only provide a historical overview of violence against Asian women, we also want to provide personal stories and experiences surrounding this complex and layered issue.
Today, in our second episode, we will cover topics that include how racist and sexist media representation of Asian, Asian American, and Pacific Islander women develop harmful stereotypes for these demographics, the flawed rhetoric behind how we talk about representation in media, and our personal experiences with how these stereotypes affect us in the present day.
We'll also have a special guest, Dr. William Gao. Dr. Gao is a San Francisco-based historian, educator, and documentary filmmaker. His research interests include Asian American history, race, and visual culture, and the history of California in the Pacific world. His current book project, tentatively entitled Performing Chinatown, Hollywood, Tourism, and the Making of a Los Angeles Community, examines the social, economic, and political context through which representations of Chinese Americans in Los Angeles were produced and consumed during the Chinese exclusion era.
Before we dive into the interview with Dr. Gao, we wanted to provide a brief overview of the different historic stereotypes that we discuss in our conversation with him. The lotus blossom stereotype, also called the China doll or geisha stereotype, defines Asian females as feminine, passive, and obedient, especially in regards to sexual behavior. This submissiveness was often in respect to white men, and Asian women are hypersexualized to please the sexual desires of white men. Madame Butterfly, Toll of the Sea, Sayonara are quintessential depictions of the Asian woman as this stereotype and feed into justifications of increased sexual aggression against Asian women. For example, there is a stereotype and fetishization that Asian women are into bondage.
The Dragon Lady stereotype is on the other end of the spectrum. So under this archetype, Asian women are described as aggressive, manipulative, powerful, and exotic seductresses. It's closely tied to ideas of yellow peril, which highlighted America's fear of Asian dominance over Western culture. Past films that played on these stereotypes include The Thief of Baghdad, Daughter of the Dragon, and The Shanghai Express. It's so funny to think that these two stereotypes are contradictory in a lot of ways, and yet we simultaneously apply them to Asian women.
Yeah, the irony is astronomical. Like, dang, if you're gonna be racist, you know, at least make it make sense.
Right? I mean, this really proves that there's no real logic to racist stereotypes. But yes, we wanted to just preface our interview with Dr. Gao with some definitions of these two major stereotypes that we'll bring up later. After our conversation with him, we'll discuss how these historic stereotypes have evolved in the present day, but for now, keep these two in mind. Hi, Dr. Gao. Thank you so much for joining us on our podcast today. Before we jump into questions, we were wondering if you could introduce yourself and your work within this field.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here today. So my name is William Gao. I'm a lecturer here at Stanford University. I use he, him pronouns. A little bit about myself in terms of how I came to this field. I'm a mixed race person. I'm half Chinese and half white. My dad's Chinese American. My mom is a white woman. And I grew up in the city of San Francisco. So I grew up in a city that was very, very which had a large Asian American population and Chinese American population in particular. And so as a young person, as someone who, you know, didn't present as Chinese, I had spent a lot of time, I think, just questioning my own identity, and that really led me to the field of Asian American studies. So my entry point was, as it is for many people in the field, kind of like questions of my own identity and belonging. And it led me to get an MA in Asian American Studies and eventually a PhD in Ethnic Studies.
Perfect. Thank you so much. So just to go into our first question, in our last episode, we discussed the implications of legislation like the Page Act, Expatriation Act of 1907, and War Brides Act of 1945 on perceptions of Asian women. So we were wondering if you see a correlation between these policies and others and the way that Asian women and people in the broader diaspora have been represented in film.
Yeah. I mean, I should just say one more thing before I get started here. I think it's just in terms of my own positionality, right? I'm really excited to talk to you about the topic of Asian American women's representations, but, you know, obviously I'm not a woman. As I just said, I identify as a man. And so my answers to these questions will be very much grounded in my own kind of a scholarly research rather than kind of like personal experiences. And I'm sure that you're speaking to many folks that identify as Asian American women. But I just want to put my kind of like positionality out there so that, you know, I'm answering these questions from my position as a scholar, obviously, rather than as someone who has like lived experiences with that. And of course, it's important, I think, to have, you know, your podcast to balance both. Having said that, I really appreciate this first question. And I think one of the things that's important to understand is if we go all the way back to the Page Act, right, which it sounds like your last episode was about, the Page Act essentially barred the entry of prostitutions on its surface, but was used in a way in which it was implemented primarily to weed out Chinese immigrants. We have, and in addition to this, the Page Act was one of the first pieces of legislation to attempt to bar people from entering into the United States. And so it's very interesting to note, even before we had the Chinese Exclusion Act, right, the Page Act in 1875 set the groundwork for a kind of federal system of immigration. And so from this very, very moment, this kind of like originary moment of American immigration law, we have the connection between kind of like racialized and gendered fears of the white population of the United States and laws trying to keep people out. And I think one thing that's very important to understand is that there's always been, since 1875 up into the present, there's always been a very close relationship between popular representation on the one hand and law and kind of policy on the other, right? Like I think in popular parlance, oftentimes people think about, you know, we've got this thing out there, you know, we've got laws and maybe then we've got misrepresentations of people in the media. And in my work, one of the things I try to move, kind of push beyond is this kind of perception and begin to think about the way in which culture actually produces understandings of race, which in turn inform the way in which policy is kind of implemented, right? And so, there's a symbiotic relationship always since the 19th century between policy and popular culture. And popular culture isn't simply a misrepresentation or a set of stereotypes that kind of misperceive something. It's actually, popular culture is actually the thing that produces our understanding of race. So we think about race and gender as being the mapping of ideas onto the human body. These ideas have to come from somewhere. And one of the, you know, scholars would tell us that one of the most kind of fundamental places where these ideas originate is through popular culture. And so as we think in terms of like being citizens and activists who want to kind of transform the world into a more equitable place, it's important that as we kind of, you know, move forward, that we're addressing simultaneously culture and the law at the same time. So I mean, having said that, that would be my kind of broad answer to this. But more specifically, right, what's interesting is that when we think about these laws that you've named, right, is that it's not just race itself, right? It's not like race is a singular category, which is connected to immigration. It's the interconnection, right? The intersectionality of race and gender. And I think that film has played an incredibly important role in that, right? I mean, obviously the 1875 Page Act comes before the beginning of cinema, right? Cinema arises sometime in the late 1890s. It's debatable what year specifically, but in the late 1890s, and you know, it doesn't become a real mass medium until at least the 1910s to early 1920s. Having said that, right, film by the 30s and 40s, certainly by the time of World War II, is the primary and most fundamental kind of form of popular entertainment in the United States. And so the things that are happening in the world of film have a profound influence on the type of policies which are being produced and on the day-to-day lives, lived experiences of Asian American women and men.
Yeah, and so we wanted to ask if there were watershed films in Hollywood that really signified to the public the standard for how Asian women were gonna be depicted and continue to be depicted. If there are any quintessential films you can think of that really play into damaging stereotypes.
Yeah, so I have a few that your listeners would be interested in. I'll name some films, but then I wanna talk more kind of broadly about the role, the representation of stereotypes as it relates to kind of like lived experiences and racial discrimination. So two really important ones to know about are both Anime Wong films. So Toll of the Sea from 1922 and Thief of Baghdad from 1924. And film scholars often hold these two films up as being the kind of quintessential kind of like originary moments of the Lotus Blossom stereotype on the one hand, and the Dragon Lady stereotype on the other. And so it's interesting when you kind of look at these two movies, right, that they're both star Anna Mae Wong, who goes on to become, the arguably the most famous Asian American woman actress ever, right? I mean, even to this day, there's probably hasn't been an actress that has had that amount of an Asian American actress that has that amount of visibility. And so in some ways, you know, I'm happy to talk about this later on. In some ways, she's able to kind of use her position in the ways that's in limited ways to kind of push back against stereotypes, but at the same time, she's also kind of like part of a larger structure which is perpetuating these stereotypes. So certainly those would be two films that I think are very, very important for understanding our representations of Asian American women. And kind of building on that though, what I think I'd like to kind of talk a little bit about though, is I think it is important for us to move somewhat away from discussions of like whether a film is a positive representation or a negative representation, which I think is the way in which it often occurs. Like this debate occurs in, you know, popular media, popular culture, like, you know, discussion all the time. Oh, that's a bad representation. This is all we need to do is take this bad representation and replace it with a better one. And what the work in cultural studies would tell us, right? If you look at people like Stuart Hall, one of the famous founders of cultural studies, Hall argues that all popular culture is a site of both containment and resistance. And so in thinking about a piece of representation like a film, rather than thinking of, oh, this is a positive representation, this whole film is a positive representation, or this entire film is a negative representation, what we should do is we should look at the film and think, well, where are the instances of containment and where are the instances of resistance? And so even in these two films, which I've named, which are like they're the archetypical, like, you know, the originary point of like the Lotus Blossom kind of stereotype, the Dragon Lady stereotype, even within these films, right? There are moments of resistance by Anna Mae Wong. And so we can't dismiss like an entire piece of work as just being stereotypical. Doing that, I think, kind of like makes, it oversimplifies the role that culture plays. And so I certainly, you know, I appreciate, you know, activists that are on the ground and kind of like the protests when they see representations that are problematic, and I'm not saying that people shouldn't do that. What I am saying though is that as kind of like viewers of film, we need to be aware that even the most kind of like even representations that on their face might seem to be very, very kind of stereotypical, if we dig deep enough, have moments of resistance in them. And all works, generally, right? Usually films are not so over the top that like you're like, oh my gosh, this is so stereotypical. Usually like, oh, this part was kind of problematic, but I like that part. Like usually it's that interplay, right, that we have to be aware of. And one of the reasons that it's so difficult to kind of like think about like having better representations is that this kind of interplay is always in the works, right? It's not like we can say, oh, we can just make this perfect representation of Asian American women, let's say in our example here. And then, you know, somehow that's gonna, you know, we can think of that, you know, the three of us could work on it, we could come up with it, we could produce it. And then the world would be a better place. That's probably not going to happen, because whatever representation we make is going to have positive aspects to it, but it's probably also at the same time going to create things that are even unintentionally create kind of ideas that are not as positive.
Thank you so much. It's really, really insightful to hear about how we should move beyond binary interpretations of these films. And so along that vein of discussing the role that Anna May Wong played in those films that she was in, we really want to explore the concept of agency, which is one really central to our podcast. And so we know that she was put in really difficult positions playing these roles that perpetuated false stereotypes. But we're also wondering about where you see Wong's agency and power coming in and her resistance coming in these films, given the limitations of her situation.
Yeah, so I should begin by saying that, you know, some of my answers here are based on the work of other scholars. People like Shirley Lim have written, you know, written wonderful books on kind of the agency of Anna May Wong. And so, you know, this is not, some of the things I'll say are not my own ideas, but, you know, ideas of others. But I think one of the things that's important to understand, right, is that Anna May Wong, what she did very, very well was utilize the press to kind of push back against the kind of stereotypical representations that we see on screen. And so let's just say, like, you're watching an Anna May Wong, you know, watching, I don't know, Toll of the Sea in an Asian American film class. If that's all you see, then you'd be pushing really hard to find those moments of resistance in there. They're there, but they're not as kind of maybe visible as you might want them to be. But if you kind of surround the film with the things that Anna May Wong is saying in the press, you know, during this period or in the period right after this, we'll see that Anna May Wong is constantly kind of pushing back against the way in which she's represented, right? So she understands on the one hand that there's this kind of structure of kind of like racism and sexism, which is kind of like defining the way in which she is being depicted in Hollywood. She uses the press to kind of declare how unsatisfied she is with those representations. And eventually, like towards the end of the silent period, she actually leaves the United States, goes to Europe to work, in part because she felt that that would be a better place for her to that she'd have more agency in her representations there. And so she produces a number of films in Europe before coming back to the United States. And continuing her career here. So she was doing what she could within this structure, right? And so I think it's really, really important to think about her as a woman with agency who is pushing constantly against the kind of stereotypes that we see. And so we can kind of talk about the way in which some of these films, as I just mentioned, kind of have long-lasting negative influences today. We can also think of Anna May Wong as being very, very symbolic of the type of like power and agency that a person can utilize, even seemingly when she has no power at all. I mean, you think about Hollywood in the 20s, right? This is like, you know, we talk about like, you know, Oscar so white today. You think about like Hollywood in the 20s was completely, absolutely 100% controlled by white men, right? And a particular class of white men at that, right? And so the idea that there were almost no white women producers, much less, you know, white, you know, like Asian women, Asian American women producers during this time. Like there were not people, you know, creatives in positions of power that could have advanced kind of like the narratives that Anna May Wong might have wanted to take part in. And so she uses the tools that are available to her to push against those stereotypes.
Yeah, and I'm sure that Anna May Wong and her films kind of had to play these roles where there's this phenomena where there's a overwhelming trend of white men with Asian women.
Yeah.
We wanted to see how ideas of yellow fever are being perpetuated in media, even back when there were anti-miscegenation laws.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that one of the things that's really interesting, right, is when you think about like relationships between white people and Asian people, like the earliest representations, like we can go back to the silent period, right? We have representations, this kind of fear of Asian men and white and white women, right? And that's a stereotype which is, you know, completely, not completely, but like, you know, for the most part disappeared. But this flip side, right, this stereotype of this kind of like yellow fever kind of phenomena, as you're calling it, right, of white men and Asian women is also around very early on. So this film, Toll of the Sea, is a film about Anna May Wong, who rescues this white sailor who washes up on the shores near her village and falls in love with him, and he's gonna take her back to America. There's this long history of this, right? And so while I think it's certainly important that, you know, I certainly feel that, you know, individuals should be able to choose whom they love and who they want to date and all, you know, on an individual level, I'm accepting of every type of relationships out there. I'm a mixed race person. My parents are mixed race. Having said that, right, at the same time, we have to point out that there are particular structures in place that often, in terms of representations of media and things like that, which often have played into imbalances of power, which have connections beyond the screen. So lots of scholars talk about the relationship, let's say, between the US military as a global force and relationships between white military personnel and Asian women, throughout the 20th century, right? There's been lots of scholars that have researched the rise of the large numbers of Asian women sex workers that often found employment outside of U.S. military bases in Asia. And I think that there's this kind of like this, there's a connection here between the way in which American media has often represented Asian women as being kind of hypersexualized or being embodying some type of sexual idea, and then acts of violence against Asian women, whether that be during wars in Asia or whether that be the more recent instances that we saw in Atlanta, right? Like, I think it's really, really interesting when we saw, the shooter in Atlanta. He came out and he said right afterwards, right? He talked about how he was motivated by a sexual addiction or something like that, right? And he used that when he said that, right? He was almost trying to say like, look, this is not an issue of race, right? Like, but if we go back to what I've been talking about for the last 15 to 20 minutes, right? Representations of race and gender have always intersected in terms of the way in which Asian American women have been seen. And so when we look at the ways in which, in that instance in particular, where we see, a white man who's gone and shot up a number of, businesses where Asian women work, I find that kind of excuse to ring very hollow. That I find it very difficult to believe that one could separate the long history of the kind of like racialized and sexualized kind of depictions of Asian American women on screen from acts of violence that are similar to that.
Definitely, I agree. And I think one of the reasons we wanted to do this podcast was to uncover why it was so accepted that his excuse was valid when there's a lot of connection here. But when looking at a lot of the history we discussed, a lot of the research we found online and conversations have been around East Asian representation. Yeah. And so we're wondering where we begin to see more nuance in representation of the diaspora that distances itself from the monolithic representation of Asians as simply falling under an East Asian broader representation.
It's a wonderful question. And what I should say is like this conversation that happens around media representation. So there's been this big like conversation since Crazy Rich Asians came out, right? Where like, if you read the mainstream press, let's say that's your first introduction to Asian American film, Crazy Rich Asian comes out and you're reading the press, you would be under the impression that this is the first Asian American film to be produced since Joy Luck Club, which was the first Asian American film to be produced since Flower Drum Song. And so we've got Flower Drum Song, Joy Luck Club, and then Crazy Rich Asians, and now Minari and a few other things. Wow, like we finally made it, right? But like that narrative is completely like aligning the existence of this robust kind of like independent Asian American cinema, which has existed since the 1970s. Much of it kind of done in the 70s and 80s by Asian American women producers. And more recently, much of it done by producers that are not East Asian American. So there's documentaries in particular have been a really fruitful place for Southeast Asian Southeast Asian American film producers to kind of get their stories out for South Asian American filmmakers to get their stories out. And so I think that it's very important that we kind of recognize the kind of large and kind of like really robust like it's not small at all. It's very, very, like, very developed kind of like Asian American media landscape, which has been going full force well before Joy Luck Club and Crazy Rich Asians. And so, for your listeners that are out there and looking for a place to turn, I'd point them to go to an Asian American film festival. CAMFest just concluded. So that's the Center for Asian American Media Film Festival. There's another big one in Los Angeles, the Visual Communications Film Festival, which is focused on Asian Americans. And then there's multiple kind of smaller ones like in Seattle and Washington, D.C. And they're all over the place, right? So like, your listeners out there can go and go to an Asian American Film Festival. And that's where you're going to find a lot of these works that are highlighting stories by Southeast Asian Americans. And other groups that have been marginalized by mainstream representations, which often depict all of Asian America as being solely East Asians.
Dr. Gao, do you have time for one more question?
I know this is let's make this the last question.
Okay. So you mentioned Ninori, and I know that there was some controversy about the category that it received.
Yes.
And so I was curious how you felt about this idea of Orientalism and, right, the East existing in relation to the West, and how Asian media, Asian American media, how they interplay.
No, I think it's a wonderful question, right? I should say that I'm of the school that believes that Asian American media is part of this thing that develops out of the idea of Asian American consciousness. So in the late 1960s, you had a group of activists, young people, mostly college educated, second and third generation, for the most part, Chinese, Japanese, and Filipino Americans, who kind of claimed this idea of they claimed this term Asian American, right? The term itself was founded by activists Yuji Ishioka and Imaji in 68 or 69, right? And so like from the beginning, this term was meant to be a very like a sense of like radical, like solidarity with third world people. And the earliest Asian American film producers were actually connected to that. So folks at Visual Communications in Los Angeles, a lot of them were actually students at UCLA's Asian American Studies Center, like in the 1970s, like, and they kind of branched off to kind of make Visual Communications, which is the first like Asian American media arts collective, right? And so for me, I see Asian American like media as having this moment in which it kind of like arises as being very, very connected to Asian American activism. And one of the things that happens, you know, I was mentioning about how this kind of mainstream media kind of like forgets all these early independent films, but it simultaneously, in forgetting them, it forgets the history of activism, like media activism, that was at the heart of Asian American media representations in the 70s, in the 80s, and in the 90s. And so then you get to a place where we're in 2020, 2021, and you have these, like, you know, you've got these representations like Minari, which I love, and, you know, Crazy Rich Asians, which I like and have some problems with, but, you know, it's a good movie. But both of these films are, even when you hear like the kind of rhetoric that comes around, like the people that are producing it, the Asian American creators behind the scene, it's more of a rhetoric around like representation, right? It's more like, oh, look, we are here, we are represented, you can see us on screen. That's the be all and end all, that's where we wanna be. And earlier folks that were involved in making Asian American media didn't see representation itself as being the kind of the be all end all goal. They saw activism. They saw media as a way to kind of push forward. You know, you think of like these canonical films like Follow the Eye Hotel, right? Which is about the removal of older Filipino workers from the Eye Hotel in San Francisco in the 1970s, right? These films like this were meant to kind of like to make people aware, not just so that people could say like, oh, look, I can see a Filipino American on screen, but so that they could understand issues of gentrification, issues of labor, issues of kind of like structural racism, which were very deeply, which were and are deeply embedded in American society. And so for me, I'm a little bit frustrated around the conversation that happens around like films like Minari, where all the conversation becomes around like issues of like, isn't it wonderful that we finally have some Asian American film that gets nominated for Academy Award. It is wonderful, but it'd be much more wonderful if we had a world that was equitable and, you know, like, and just. So yeah, that'll be my last thought, I think.
Thank you so much. We really, really appreciate this and appreciate you making the time.
Thank you. Please share it with me when you're done.
Yeah.
Okay, bye.
Thank you.
You're about to listen to Therese and I debrief a little after the call.
Yeah, what Dr. Gao was saying about like understanding the legacy of Asian films that have come before, both documentary and fictional, leads me to other questions about narrative construction in film. Because I know in Asian American literature, a huge conversation is about whether to privilege form, narrative form or content when it comes to evaluating a piece's revolutionary qualities and activist qualities. And so I'm just curious about how that factors in with film. I'm not a film expert myself, and so I don't know much about the construction of a film and narrative, and especially, you know, between different genres. But we've been talking a lot about the presence of seeing an Asian face on screen, but there have been a lot of Asian American filmmakers who have been involved in films that don't necessarily fall under this category of Asian American film or representation. So just curious, like now, as to what constitutes Asian American film, and whether the way an Asian American film is constructed affects how we perceive it and the properties that the general public ascribes to it.
Yeah, I mean, you said that so eloquently. I don't know that I have much to add, but I think it was a really important point of critique that Dr. Gao brought up about, yeah, the conversation we're having, you know, not letting representation just become a buzzword that we talk about, and really looking back at the historical roots of activism that Asian American literature, media, film, like all of those were rooted in. So cool. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. That was such a good conversation. I think my last follow-up thought is like, he talked a lot in that last answer about what Asian American film can do for activism, but I'm curious about whether a film's aesthetic afterlife can just be existing for the sake of watching for pleasure without having any correlation to some sort of like greater political aim for Asian Americans. Like, is that possible in a white supremacist landscape, or is every Asian American film necessarily going to be tied to collective liberation?
And earlier he was talking about how media is always tied to policies and legislation. About media coverage that already exists and will follow this pandemic, and also specifically like anti-Asian hate crimes that are happening. And I think it was in California, or maybe it was more local to the Bay, there was some sort of legislation about anti-Asian hate crimes, or, you know, Asians. And I'd be curious to see how the moment we're in and how we represent this moment is going to affect policies that affect Asian Americans, Asian individuals, Pacific Islanders, yeah.
Those were our thoughts on our conversation with Dr. Gao. We'll now take a brief intermission before resuming to the rest of our podcast.
Okay, so before the intermission, we had been speaking to Dr. Gao. We discussed representations of Asian women in film, the reclamation of agency by actresses like Anna Mae Wong and other Asian femme actresses when forced to play stereotypical roles. And we also talked about going beyond binary analyses of representation that goes beyond, is something good or bad? All of Dr. Gao's insights are deeply important for understanding how Asian women are perceived today, because as we know, film can be an important medium when it comes to perceptions of marginalized groups by society at large. Unfortunately for Asian women, a century's worth of films depicting us through the Lotus Blossom and Dragon Lady stereotypes, among many others, has been particularly dehumanizing and caused a lot of harm.
Right, and I want to clarify that the Lotus Blossom stereotype and the Dragon Lady stereotype are not things of the past. They absolutely inform stereotypes that exist today, including the most well-known one. And honestly, it's used so much that I don't even really want to talk about it, but we probably should. So I'm talking about the model minority stereotype.
Mm-hmm. This is the classic three-word phrase that's been broadly used to describe how Asian Americans are described in the broader American landscape.
But yeah, I shouldn't assume that all of our listeners have heard of this term. So the model minority myth is this idea that Asians and Asian Americans were standing proof that the American dream is feasible for people of color and immigrants and other marginalized groups. It's American cultural essentialism to a T, saying that, see, you know, look at these Asians, they're getting good grades, they're going to college, they're getting good jobs, they're buying houses. So all you need is hard work, you know, pick yourself up by the bootstraps. And it was entirely used as an anti-Black racial project meant to serve as an antithesis to the myth of the welfare queen. Racist politicians use the model minority myth to paint a picture of Black people as lazy folks who mooch off government resources because they're unable to partake in America's meritocracy, rather than acknowledging that wealth disparities are a direct result of systems of oppression and discrimination. Asians have been used as pawns for white America to further their agenda of cementing anti-blackness and stratifying the position of white families as the elite standard. It's really set up this messed idea of the deserving and undeserving poor.
Yes, that's a perfect description of what the model minority myth is. Researchers Jennifer Lee and Min Zhao really break down the mechanisms that brought about the success of Asian immigrants and Asian Americans. There was the fact that as immigrants, we were hyper-selected. So Asians who were approved to come to the US, especially East and South Asians, are some of the most highly educated and skilled from their respective host countries. And then because we arrive within a success frame and stereotype promise that we are smart or capable, those are often the biases that institutions treat us with. That allows Asians to build ethnic capital like supplementary forms of support, such as Chinese college preparatory schools, or other things that aren't necessarily available to other ethnic and racial groups.
Mm-hmm. And something else that's really important to point out is how Asians and Pacific Islanders who don't have these same experiences, who face language and cultural barriers, who don't receive these types of resources, who are coming as refugees, are always lumped together as part of this model minority. And so I grew up in San Jose, and living there, I had always counted myself lucky to have been surrounded by all this ethnic and cultural diversity and people that looked like me. And yet, as I've grown older, I've realized how skewed my notions of the Asian American identity were. Because when I thought about Asians, I thought about kids who were in my classrooms, and that included Chinese, Korean, Japanese, Indian, Vietnamese, and Filipino families. And we were among the kids who the model minority often did apply to. And many of my peers were similarly high-achieving students. And admittedly, I had attributed it to an Asian culture of strict disciplinary parenting. And it really wasn't until college that I had met any Laos, Cambodian, Hmong, Indonesian, Tongan, Fijian, Native Hawaiian, Mongolian, Samoan students. And I'm leaving out many too. But I just realized that these identities have been almost entirely erased out of the narrative of what it means to be part of the AAPI community in America.
Yeah, I really resonate with that. I mean, I grew up in Fresno and didn't encounter as much diversity growing up, but I still also had a really limited notion of what the Asian American identity was composed of. And I think Asian American immigrants are first associated with being high income and from East Asian countries like China, Japan, and Korea, which, as you said, erases a lot of Southeast, and Central Asians from the narrative. And when we think about why this is, as well as the impact this has on femme individuals from these various places, I think it's really important to consider the unique histories of each Asian country in relation to America. These histories impact the reasons behind immigration and the socioeconomic status and jobs of these immigrant groups, as well as their descendants. And these features, in turn, impact the ways that women from different Asian countries are treated and perceived. For example, I'm Filipino, and so I'm most familiar with Filipino history. So for me, I'm always acutely aware of how the history of American colonialism in the Philippines has impacted migration of Filipino Americans, and as a result, the stereotypes and mistreatment that Filipino people, and Filipino women in particular, have had to combat. And this applies to the experiences of all marginalized identities within the diaspora. Immigrants and their descendants from other formerly colonized countries can really share in this experience in particular. But women in every ethnic group within the Asian diaspora are forced to work against broader stereotypes like the model minority myth, as well as those specific to their ethnicity. And this can be especially difficult for women who are conflated into the East Asian category because of the erasure of their identities. This is really pertinent for Pacific Islander women. The term AAPI is thrown around really casually these days, but many people forget to acknowledge the richness in those last two letters, Pacific Islander. Just for some context, the Pacific Islands refer to three major regions, Polynesia, Melanesia, and Micronesia, which cover regions from New Zealand to Palau and thousands of other islands. Bringing the conversation back to film and media, there are so few Pacific Islander films that are brought to mainstream attention, and representation is sparse as a result. Pacific Islanders are often unfairly portrayed as simple, happy-go-lucky people who are always situated against a backdrop of a vacation paradise for tourists, which is their home, but they're never really given complex storylines of their own. And because of the lack of representation, Pacific Islanders are conflated with the broader Asian American identity, which results in them being subject to the stereotypes we've discussed today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that. And I'm so glad we're talking about this because I was interviewing Anamatangi Polynesian Voices in East Palo Alto just last week, and they're a family-run 501c3 that provides all sorts of services to Pacific Islanders in the Bay. And I won't go into the details about it, but basically when we started the interview, they were kind of scolding me for asking to speak with them on such short notice and without working with them first. And they were saying that the ways that I approached them and asked for this interview was really American and westernized, that they were really tired of Stanford researchers coming in to extract knowledge without actually helping or compensating them for their labor or really caring about the community. So after they scolded me, she started asking about my ancestry. And so I was explaining that I'm from Okinawa. And she, her name is Shauna, a wonderful, wonderful lady. And she looked at me and you can tell that she kind of starts to warm up and she goes, "Look, like you're from Okinawa, you're an islander too. And you can't forget the ways of your ancestors and people just because you're working for an institution. You need to remember to fund yourself through your research and always center your identity in any work you decide to take on." And hearing this, it just sort of reminded me that, yeah, you know, Okinawans are an indigenous islander population that was its own kingdom and country long before it was first colonized by mainland Japan and then became a U.S. territory and now a site of U.S. military occupation. You know, that's where I come from. That's me. But because this idea of the model minority is so pushed upon young AAPI girls, I just never thought to put my Okinawan heritage at the forefront of my identity growing up. Mm-hmm. And just to bring it back to how this affects young Asian girls, I don't know if this is true for you, Therese, but growing up, the stereotype was that young Asian girls are these unattractive geeks who have tiger parents and only care about straight A's. And maybe we have weird accents and weird lunches, and we're not really given the agency to be seen outside of this box, even if we exist completely differently. But then as you go through puberty, the stereotype then is that Asian girls take all this repressed energy and years of obedience, and then we have a wild rebellious stage. And I think that's where stereotypes like the ABG or the Asian baby girl comes from. So all of a sudden we go from being these undesirable young girls into these uber sexualized young women. And I think it's really damaging. We spend so much of our lives just trying to break out of stereotypes that we're not really given the luxury to discover and simply be who we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you put that so eloquently and I can totally relate to this experience as well. I mean, I remember spending so much time holding myself up to white beauty standards and literally not wanting to wear glasses or anything like that because I didn't want to be associated even further with the model minority stereotype. I wanted to be seen as more than that, with all parts of my identity recognized and visible. And I think that's what makes these stereotypes so dehumanizing. They limit the scope of who Asian women are capable of becoming. They paint us as one-dimensional and as vehicles for male sexual pleasure and or to service white supremacist agendas. And that's why it's really important to undo the damage of these stereotypes and demonstrate the richness that Asian women live out in their daily lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, up to now, we've been talking about how Asian women are depicted in traditional forms of media, but I also wanted to highlight examples of Asian women who are actively reshaping and taking agency over this hackneyed narrative of Asian women as submissive and helpless. So, you know, it's 2021, we're in the age of social media, and there's a student named Lillian Sun who's gone viral for posting the ridiculously racist and misogynistic comments she gets on Tinder directed at her as an Asian woman. And so the kind of submissions that she gets is from guys who say things like, "Oh, I'll eat your pussy like shrimp fried rice," or, I've never been with an Asian before, so banging you would be a dream come true. I need my yellow fever cured. I want to absolutely dominate your small Asian body. Yeah, it's a lot. Mm-hmm. So for those of you listening, I recommend you pause and look up The Fleshlight Chronicles on Instagram. Again, that's The Fleshlight Chronicles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really recommend everybody look at that page. I think it's really important to look at her work in particular to see how Asian women are reclaiming their agency and undoing the harm from these stereotypes through artistic expression that highlights the omnipresence of sexual violence in Asian women's lives, but also the power that we have to stand against these things.
Right. And something really insightful that she talks about in one of these posts is how fetishization isn't a preference. What fetishization is it's sexual prejudice combined with power. And I think this is a really powerful framework to look at what we were talking about in last week's episode about racial discrepancies in the dating world.
Mm-hmm. I think it's so important to identify that crucial piece about power. Power to define what is other, what is outside the boundaries of civility and worth. Every time men call upon bodies of color as sexualized, othered bodies, they're reproducing the historical trauma of war, conquest, slavery, and incarceration. So the stereotypes that give rise to fetishization are rooted in violence. It's not just microaggressions. These are words that are meant to dehumanize, to oppress, and to make violence easier to enact upon these bodies. Asian women's bodies are once again seen as vessels meant to serve white men.
Yeah, and I think Lillian explains this idea better than I definitely could, so I'll just read an excerpt of one of the captions she wrote. So, quote, "The submissiveness of the Asian body comes from wartime propaganda, the savagery of the black body from slavery. And it is not a coincidence that queer and trans folks are fetishized, given that historically they have been incarcerated and killed on grounds of mental illnesses or abnormality. And it is also not a coincidence that we have all been stereotyped to be hypersexual, because it is easier for those who commit violence to imagine that we all want it. When you fetishize, you become complicit in the perpetuation of our historical trauma. You become complicit in dynamics that to this day still contribute to higher statistics of sexual assault, suicide, depression, and murder for marginalized people. It takes a very special kind of selfishness and flippant disregard for human decency to purposely target vulnerable populations for the very reason that they are vulnerable. So for those who have been victimized, do not let anyone tell you ever again that you are being crazy or irrational when you talk about fetishization. There is nothing flattering about being made into something less than human."
Mm, such a powerful quote. I really recommend that everybody take the time to reread that on her page. I think it really highlights how damaging it is to conflate being desired and being fetishized. Being an object of desire when that desire is rooted in historical violence and trauma is, as she says, dehumanizing. It's not a compliment when someone wants you because of this false idea of who they think you are and what purpose you're meant to serve. It's an insult because it means that you aren't being recognized as a person of your own. You're seen as an idea and a fantasy. I personally really appreciate her work because she not only uses her platform to explain and help others understand the trauma that can come from being fetishized, she also creates art that allows her to demonstrate her power in spite of these situations she's been placed in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, scrolling through her page always leaves me with this weird mix of emotions, from absolutely disgusted and horrified to really proud and empowered. So, okay, we've been talking for a while now, and I think this is a perfect transition to what we'll be discussing in our next episode, the impact of fetishization on Asian women at Stanford and the ways they've reclaimed their agency in spite of the harm of these situations. Lillian is one of many women who has been impacted by fetishization and stereotypes about Asian women. And in our next episode, we'll be talking to other women our age about their experiences with these things as well.
Thank you so much for joining us today for this episode of No History, No Self.
I know we covered some very heavy topics today, so please remember to take a few moments to rest and sit with this information. If you'd like to support our podcast, make sure to subscribe to our channel, and we'll see you next week.
Yes, and before we leave, I just want to end with a note that to all our powerful, wise, beautiful, amazing listeners out there, especially AAPI women, remember to not let anyone gaslight or water down your experiences. They are your stories to harness towards becoming the badasses that you want to become. And Teresa and I will be rooting for you from thousands of miles away.
Yes, we will.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Yeah, what Dr. Gao was saying about like understanding the legacy of Asian films that have come before, both documentary and fictional, leads me to other questions about narrative construction in film. Because I know in Asian American literature, a huge conversation is about whether to privilege form, narrative form or content when it comes to evaluating a piece's revolutionary qualities and activist qualities. And so I'm just curious about how that factors in with film. I'm not a film expert myself, and so I don't know much about the construction of a film and narrative, and especially, you know, between different genres. But we've been talking a lot about the presence of seeing an Asian face on screen, but there have been a lot of Asian American filmmakers who have been involved in films that don't necessarily fall under this category of Asian American film or representation. So just curious, like, now as to what constitutes Asian American film, and whether the way an Asian American film is constructed affects how we perceive it and the properties that the general public ascribes to it.
Yeah, I mean, you said that so eloquently. I don't know that I have much to add, but I think it was a really important point of critique that Dr. Gao brought up about, yeah, the conversation we're having, you know, not letting representation just become a buzzword that we talk about, and really looking back at the historical roots of activism that Asian American literature, media, film, like all of those were rooted in. So cool. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. That was such a good conversation. I think my last follow-up thought is like, he talked a lot in that last answer about what Asian American film can do for activism. But I'm curious about whether a film's aesthetic afterlife can just be existing for the sake of watching for pleasure without having any correlation to some sort of like greater political aim for Asian Americans. Like, is that possible in a white supremacist landscape, or is every Asian American film necessarily going to be tied to collective liberation?
And earlier he was talking about how media is always tied to policies and legislation. About media coverage that already exists and will follow this pandemic, and also specifically like anti-Asian hate crimes that are happening. And I think it was in California, or maybe it was more local to the Bay, there was some sort of legislation about anti-Asian hate crimes, or, you know, stopping Asians. And I'd be curious to see how the moment we're in and how we represent this moment is going to affect policies that affect Asian Americans, Asian individuals, Pacific Islanders. Yeah.